Welcome to a new edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, thank you so much for tuning in as we continue to pour through the big old monster box of baseball cards from the 80s and early 1990s. And finally, after 5 weeks, and how many podcasts would that be? 10 podcasts. We're finally done with 1992. And there was much rejoicing. Yay! Although we do wrap up 1992 with one of the best sets from that year, no, it wasn't quite up to the standards of Fleer Ultra or Top Stadium Club. However, 1992 tops a very big step forward, not only for that particular card, but also for the Topps brand, as they completely revitalized the card, much like everybody else had to in 1992, trying to catch up or surpass Upper Deck in the quality department. And Topps certainly did that with the set. And we've got a pretty interesting random pull for this podcast. Card number 605, Scott Erickson. And Scott Erickson is one of those guys who, professionally, he actually played quite a long time. In fact, longer than I realized when I was kind of looking back through his stats, because I only remember him really from the early to mid-90s. But he actually played 15 seasons in the major leagues. But he falls into that category, and it's almost always pitchers that fall into this category, not of, you know, being a one-hit wonder or a one-season wonder. But he's remembered for one particular season. So he kind of falls into that bucket with Joe Black, Mark Fidrick. I'd even put Denny McClain in there, with that 31 season he had in 1968. Scott Erickson played 15 seasons in the big leagues, actually had two or three decent seasons in his career. But he will always be remembered for his 1991 season, that 20-game winning season for the team that would eventually win the World Series, the Minnesota Twins, that year. And he's also often remembered for a little quirk that he had in his uniform, as he didn't wear the typical white undersocks with his stirrups, the dark blue stirrups that the Twins wore back then. He wore black socks. And much like the cameras were focused on Curt Schilling's ankle throughout the 2004 playoffs. I remember in the 91 World Series, the cameras were focused on Scott Erickson's feet because he wore black socks. This was somehow some great revelation in the world of sports. So we'll talk about Scott Erickson and the 92 top set as well after we first hear from you. We want to listen to what you're talking about on our Wax Ecstatic Twitter feed that is at Wax and Gum Stains. A lot of talk over the last few weeks, a lot of it stemming from our podcast that we recently did on the 92 Top Stadium Club set. And some comments on that topic, including from our friend WaxPack916 when we were previewing the set and posted a picture of a couple of boxes. He wrote in, "This is the first set that I built through packs and a box. Pretty sure I have a couple of bricks, Series 1 and 2, laying around." And of course, literal bricks, as the UV coating probably glued most of those cards together 25 years later. So you've got little stacks of these cards laying around your house, as does everybody else who collected those in mass quantities. Now, WaxPack916 also added a question: future podcast ideas, ever consider 80s hockey or football? Yes and no. I didn't really collect football cards until, 89, 90. And I didn't collect as much of them as I did baseball and hockey. And also, there were so many phenomenal players in the NFL in the 80s whose rookie cards came out in the 80s that, you know, my standard way of collecting cards through opening up packs, buying boxes, that was kind of cost prohibitive because, you know, when you've got packs featuring rookie cards of, Joe Montana and Steve Young and Bo Jackson and, you know, you name Jerry Rice, all the stars from the 1980s, they were not cheap. So I really didn't invest in a whole lot of football cards from the 1980s. I do have some, but not a whole lot. Now, hockey, however, I have, much like in collecting my baseball cards, hockey, I've got cards going back to the 1960s. A lot of them are commons, but I don't care. It's just cool to have old cards around. And I certainly do have quite a few from the 80s. Now, there were some limited cards from like 84, 85, 86, because again, you had some big name rookies, Mario Lemieux, Patrick Waugh, for example. So I wasn't able to buy a whole lot of packs, but I do have some individual cards. As tempting as it would be to do that, I just don't think it's in the cards, no pun intended, in the short term. It is something, however, I'll put that idea in the back of my head because it would be fun to look through some of the old hockey cards. And I've got some real doozies because when I was a kid, I specialized in collecting not just any old hockey cards, but if I could get my hands on defunct teams. And the NHL certainly had its garbage pile of defunct teams, such as the Kansas City Scouts, and the Colorado Rockies and the Atlanta Flames and the California Golden Seals. And then, of course, as time went on and teams relocated again in the 90s, you had the Hartford Whalers, the Quebec Nordiques, the original Winnipeg Jets. So, you know, there's plenty of interesting cards in my collection there. But for the time being, Wax Pack 916, as tempted as I am to go, hey, I should probably do that, it's actually in the best interest that I don't do it right now. Now, part of the idea for podcasts came through Chris Starr, who suggested that we do a podcast on non-logo or minor league cards. And I said, you know what, that's actually a good idea. So when we get through 1993, which is the final year of the cards in this monster box, I will do 2 to 3 separate podcasts on minor league cards just in general, non-logo cards just in general. And, you know, we'll kind of pick through those. And like I said, I've got to actually find some of those cards because they're not as easily accessible as this monster box is. But that is something that, you know, we'll probably get to. I mean, it took us 10 podcasts to get through 1992. So probably 8 to 10 podcasts to get through the 1993 cards. And then we'll go ahead and address that. And as a token of his appreciation, he sent a scan of a Topps Captain Crunch Dale Murphy card. Now, this is actually a little more legit because Topps made it. However, because it was Captain Crunch is Post Cereals, I believe, because Post didn't have an agreement with the Players Association, they had to do the non-logo. So you have Dale Murphy wearing the blotted out Atlanta Braves hat there. So that was a very nice find there. So yeah, we will definitely do the minor league and non-logo cards, but the hockey cards I've got to put on the back burner right now. Now, some interesting thoughts about this upcoming podcast. As we teased out through Twitter earlier on Thursday, that we were going to be doing a podcast on 92 Tops. And of course, I mentioned it in the podcast on Tuesday when we were talking about Top Stadium Club. Peter Steinberg chiming in, I just got into 92 Tops for the first time late last year and really like it, especially the cards featuring ballparks on the back, and particularly for those ballparks that are now gone, not that they were any great shakes. And that's something, you know, we'll talk, you know, in details about that. That's one of the aspects of the 92 Tops card that I like, but had some pros and cons to it. You know, I thought that was a pretty neat addition there. So we'll get in a little more detail of that. Now, speaking of baseball card backs, you knew baseball card backs would chime in because they're not a big fan of Top Stadium Club backs, even though I am. So first, regarding Top Stadium Club, he sends a scan of a 93 Top Stadium Club Mike Hampton. And I'll be honest, I don't like how they laid out the back of the Stadium Club cards in 1993. I also don't like, remember what I said about showing off the rookie cards? I said, you know, Topps would kind of fudge it a little bit, you know, show off the Topps Major League debut or Topps traded card as the player's rookie card. Well, the 93 Stadium Club Mike Hampton card lists its official rookie card as the 93 Topps Stadium Club Mike Hampton card. So you can't do a mirror image, you know, hey, let's show off his rookie card. Oops, you already got it. Ha ha ha. It has a very 1993 look to it. a very Nickelodeon or MTV from 1993 look to it. So I don't like the general design, although I actually do like, you know, how they broke things down on there a little more scientifically than the standard back of a card. But Baseball Card Backs writes, the rookie card on this one is itself, yes. Just when I was starting to have a good day, you had to remind me about the Stadium Club backs. Well, I'm sorry. And he chimes in, also not a fan of the stadium pictures on 92 Tops. And he has this little imaginary dialogue. We have a 3/8 inch by 3 inch area where we usually put highlights. What should we put this year? A photo of an entire baseball stadium? Perfect. And I'm sure that probably was kicked around the board at Tops going, well, why do we put down here, well, I've got some stock footage of Milwaukee County Stadium. Can we put in a frame of that? Absolutely. That's genius. So I'd be curious to be in that room, or I'd like to be a fly on the wall when that conversation was carried out there. By the way, Baseball Card Backs, not totally against me, agrees with me on Larry Walker, the random pull of our Top Stadium Club podcast being Hall of Fame worthy. And one other final thought about Larry Walker, Philip Hubert says, okay, I like 92 Stadium Club. Walker more likely running toward DH than the Hall. Well, Philip, I have to remind you, if you look at Larry Walker's stats, because he was a career National League player, the only time that he played designated hitter was during interleague play. So he had over 1,800 games total in the big leagues, and well over 1,700 of them were in the outfield. He was a position player, so when you have 95% or roughly 95%, I didn't do the math, but roughly 95% of your career is actually in the field, hard to say you're a DH player just completely. And, you know, that's part of the argument that Edgar Martinez is dealing with right now. And Edgar was the topic of our 89 score podcast a while back. You can listen to that if you'd like. But the general argument I've made is, even though Edgar certainly specialized in DH for much of his career, the latter three quarters of his career, people tend to forget. Yeah, I know baseball writers tend to have a brain fart, but they tend to forget that the only reason why Edgar Martinez was playing in the designated hitter role for so long was he completely mangled his knee in an injury in, I think it was 1992. He was actually a very productive all-star third baseman for the Mariners before he had that knee injury, and he was never quite the same. So they put his bat to good use as opposed to counting on him tearing up his knee again on the turf at the Old Kingdom. So, I'm a big believer that, even a guy like Edgar Martinez should be in the Hall of Fame, but don't say that Larry Walker is a designated hitter, because he wasn't. He did play the DH role several times in his career. But again, that was just interleague play during the last, 7 or 8 years when the Rockies or Cardinals just needed a bat in the lineup against an American League opponent in the American League ballpark. He was able to provide that for them. So thank you for providing me with your comments and thoughts and questions on Wax and Gum Stains. Again, our Twitter feed, which is open 24/7. So make sure you share that with your friends. Let them know whether they're collecting now or collected back in the day that the Twitter feed is open. And I look forward to their comments and questions. And also remind your friends that the Wax Ecstatic podcast comes your way every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. And we have our complete archive up on Audio Boom. Just visit audioboom.com, type in Wax Ecstatic, and you will find it there. Now, before we talk about 92 Tops, I do want to mention that I have seen pictures of the 2017 Tops. And Tops actually sent out a tweet of a promo card. I think it was Clayton Kershaw from, I want to say maybe November. And I liked it then. I haven't had the chance to buy some yet. I'm juggling enough things to keep my balanced budget going. Buying a stack of baseball cards won't do it. But even though, I look fondly back at a lot of these older sets, I do still occasionally buy new cards, although my vice is Topps Heritage, and I eagerly await the release of that shortly, as they will be modeling those cards after the legendary 1968 Topps set. But I have seen pictures and some breaks of the 2017 set. Looks really nice. So even if you haven't been a big collector, it's always fun when it's you know, baseball card release day, which was on February 1st. So you'll start seeing more and more of those, not just in hobby shops, but also in retail locations, which nowadays is mostly Target and Walmart, but I have seen them show up at other places. In fact, the strangest place I've seen baseball cards sold these days, Bed Bath & Beyond. Yeah, and trust me, I'm not a frequent shopper there. I was actually picking up something for a summer vacation, some beach toys, and I'm making my way to the register, and I see it was actually Topps opening day. I'm like, wait a minute, they sell baseball cards here? It was actually kind of a neat flashback to the early 90s where everybody sold them. It wasn't just, you know, the warehouse stores or local hobby shop. And of course, there were a lot more hobby shops back then, but you saw them in drugstores and grocery stores, you named it. So even though it was rather bizarre, it was kind of neat to see it out there. All right, let's take a look back at the 92 Topps set, a huge step forward for the Topps company. And even though when we discussed the 91 Topps set a few weeks back, and I lamented how 91 Topps was really the last fun set of baseball cards because the hobby had grown into an industry and, you know, everybody had to improve the card stock and everybody had to put in shiny inserts and, you know, there was no more bubble gum in the cards. Even though I lamented that, I do have to say that 92 Topps is still one of my favorite sets. It is the only factory set that I own. You know, like I said, I didn't really collect factory sets. I always like putting together sets through buying boxes and packs. I received it as a Christmas gift in 1992, and I still have it, although the seal was broken because I had to see what those bonus 8 gold cards were. But it's always been a fun set. And a lot of great players, of course, a lot of the young players that we grew up with, my generation that we're now seeing enter the Hall of Fame. Maybe they had a rookie card in the set or one of their earlier cards. And I think even though, you know, now I look back wistfully on 91 Topps and think, well, that was the end of an era. 92 Topps has just some really quality cards. The value of the cards is still a smidge higher than, you know, what a lot of the previous sets in 90, 91 were. And that goes to be shown in the value of wax boxes and complete factory sets. They're still out there. They're a little higher than some of the other products from 1992. And let's take a look at our random pull card number 605, Scott Erickson. We'll start with the front. And the first, the most obvious thing that you notice here is the different card stock. They went with the thicker white card stock, which a lot of other companies have been using for a few years. Topps hadn't always been using gray card stock. In fact, from 1963, I think I might be off a year, might be 64, through 1969, they used the white card stock. But ever since then, they'd used the gray card stock. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But there's no doubt when you go looking through cards from 1992 Topps, the pictures just look better, the stats are easier to read, the whole thing just pops better. And you're sitting there wondering, well, why didn't Topps do this years ago? Especially since, you know, Don Russ and Fleer was always using white card stock, but it was always an inferior card stock. You know, Don Russ was especially flimsy and brittle, and Fleer, you know, I mentioned this in some of their earlier sets, especially 81 and 82, the cards would eventually bow over time as they're sitting in a box. So it wasn't very high quality. You have to wonder if Topps had made that change to white card stock maybe in the mid-80s, would they have just completely dominated the hobby before Score came around with a quality product in 88 and, of course, Upper Deck in 89, launching the bar well above the competition for a few years. So the card stock is a huge, huge improvement. And when you look at the design of 92 Topps, it's actually very similar to 91 Topps in that you have a white border. You have a prominently featured color photograph, a lot of action shots in 92 as well as 91. You have an inner border that is color coordinated with the team that the player plays for. And at the bottom, you have, in this case, two bars with the player's name in the left-hand bar. And on the right side, the team name. Now, Topps did not go with the secondary script or the secondary logo that they used in 91. They didn't use team logos, instead just opting for just this kind of generic script for writing the team names there. But much like 91 Topps, a very simple, very clean, very basic, classic, and really good-looking card. And what is really neat about this is the inner frame kind of acts, you know, almost like it's an in-focus, you know, even though, especially in this case here, you know, it's Scott Erickson, you know, winding up about to release a pitch. It kind of puts everything else in the background and on the sides kind of blurry, and you really do focus in on the center of the attention here. And the photography in 92 Topps is outstanding. It is not quite Stadium Club quality. We're not looking at, you know, the Kodachrome quality pictures, but I thought the pictures were always good quality. They were always clean and crisp, but also the action shots that they use, but also some of the stage shots. Cal Ripken Jr. leaning on Lou Gehrig's plaque at Yankee Stadium. I mean, that is just an incredible, very artistic shot. Kelly Gruber, you know, I was a Blue Jays fan. I always thought this was a neat card, even though Kelly Gruber was, you know, an average to pretty good third baseman throughout his career. Topps gave him a little extra special treatment where, you know, he's leaning, you know, he's got his bat behind his shoulder blades, and he's got his forearms kind of draped over the front. And you can tell that this is on a hot afternoon, and he's just kind of laughing. And, you know, the sunlight is behind him, and it's got this really cool, like, sunset effect on him. So, I mean, even, you know, average players were getting a little extra special treatment with some of the photography. And then he had, you know, pictures like Ken Griffey Jr. His card is memorable as well, because, you know, he's just slid into a base and is asking an umpire for time. So Ken Griffey Jr. isn't centered. He's actually kind of off to the side, but right above his, you know, nameplate. And it's actually kind of neat how that picture played out there. So some good photo selections, certainly great photo quality, and something that they started in 91. Was really accentuated in 1992, and it really looks good. I can't think of a bad photograph in 92 Topps. Granted, it's a 792 card set. I haven't looked through each and every card. There's probably one still out there. I know Topps was still airbrushing some cards back then, so, you know, there are a couple that kind of slip in under the radar, but in general, 92 Topps had a pretty good array of photographs, and quality, and the types of shots that they used were all very good overall. Now, let's flip the card over to the back, and this is where we have some controversy, as the design of 92 Topps brought in a very neat feature. I liked it. I know some of our listeners like it. Some of our listeners don't like it, but let's get the basics out of the way. Upper left-hand corner, you had the card number, you had the player's name, personal information right underneath it, and then his complete professional stats. Underneath that, a little bit of a tidbit here, you know, some landmark games that Scott Erickson had in 1991, and, well, he had quite a few. And then, if space permitted, Topps included a picture of the team or the player's home ballpark. Now, here are the pros. I always loved this because, again, this was when I was really starting to get into not only the history of the game, but then the history of the ballparks. So I wanted to know everything I could about every ballpark, not just presently in the major leagues, but this is when I really started reading up on ballparks of the past, or lost ballparks, you know, green fields, whatever you want to call them. So to see a baseball card company actually show pictures of ballparks was kind of neat. Now, while baseball card backs, as I mentioned, you know, kind of made fun of this tiny little space being used for pictures, keep in mind this one fact. 1992, this was what? Pre-internet. If you wanted to look at pictures of ballparks, you had to go to the library. Or, you know, you had to be in the city where the ballpark was. You could take your own pictures. Now, and, you know, especially using the example of the Scott Erickson card, if I want to look at the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome in Minneapolis, and I'm not really sure why, but if I was encouraged to look at it, I could just type it into Google Images, hit return, and, you know, I've got 3,000 pictures of the Metrodome. And probably at the top of the list of pictures are the Metrodome's implosion and destruction, because the place was just an absolute pit. But, you know, nowadays you can just, I mean, you can look at it on your phone if you want to. You can get hundreds and thousands of pictures of the same stadium. Well, in 1992, you couldn't. So this was another way that Topps was bringing the sport to the fans. And again, at this point in my life, I'm 14, 15 years old. I wasn't going to Minneapolis at any point in time to see the Metrodome in person. So the Metrodome is brought to me, and it's a neat interior picture here. Now that's the key. Interior. There are some variations on cards where Topps decided to use the exterior shot. And think again, 1992, this was the first year of the retro ballpark. Camden Yards in Baltimore opened in 1992. So you are dealing with a lot of the ashtray-shaped, toilet bowl-shaped, multi-purpose cookie-cutter stadiums, you name it. Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, St. Louis, Philadelphia. You have the dome stadiums, and they weren't just dome stadiums. They were ugly dome stadiums, like the Metrodome, like the Kingdome in Seattle. So you had a lot of ballparks that didn't really have any character to it. They were just really ugly. Olympic Stadium in Montreal, same thing. So, there were some limitations to the pictures. Also, there were limitations in how the pictures were presented. So on these player cards, they were presented in this narrow, almost like a widescreen panoramic view, which in some cases worked, in some cases didn't. Now, on the back of the dreaded manager card, because those cards had the manager stats listed vertically as opposed to the baseball player stats listed horizontally, well, the aspect ratio of the photograph had to change. So you would have, just this kind of, like if you look at Philippe Alou's card, it's just this kind of boxy picture, exterior picture of Olympic Stadium in Montreal, which of course looks like something that came out of, the War of the Worlds. It didn't really look that good. And the longer a manager was in the game, for example, Tony La Russa, well, you had to squish that picture a little more, because by 1992, La Russa had been managing the big leagues for 14, 15 years, as opposed to other managers who may have been in for just 7 or 8 years, and the picture was a slightly different aspect ratio. And by the way, the picture of the Oakland Coliseum is actually very cool, because this was before Mount Davis was built in the mid-90s for Al Davis and the Oakland Raiders to return from Los Angeles. So, you've got some pretty interesting views. And like Peter Steinberg mentioned in our fan comments, it's neat to see the stadiums that don't exist anymore or that look drastically different, like Oakland. Oakland looks completely different now. Memorial Stadium, for the Orioles, again, because they had just finished in Memorial Stadium, they didn't have any pictures of Camden Yards. So that was your last chance to see Memorial Stadium. Or even a dump like Cleveland Municipal Stadium. You get to see those. So there are some good ones to look at, and then plenty of not so good ones to look at. So again, some pros and cons. Could Topps have done something better with that space? I will argue, yes. You could have had some in-depth stats. You could have had some more trivial tidbits. You could have, a different picture on the back, a picture of the player in action, much like a lot of the other cards had done by 1992. But I will give Topps credit for this. Again, pre-internet, bringing the game to the fan in the form of, oh, here's a picture of the stadium they play in, but also coming up with something that nobody else was doing. The closest this comes to Upper Deck in 1992, their team checklist, and they had some artwork checklists, which are actually very nice. In 1992, Upper Deck would incorporate some aspect of the player's ballpark in the painting, but that was it. Nobody else had ever put a picture of a stadium on the back of a player's card or a manager's card. Now, Fleer in, I think, 87 or 88, the back of their stickers were often pictures of stadiums. But as for actually incorporating it within the baseball card, that had not been done before, and I thought that was very neat. Now, there is also one other exception. This isn't the first stadium card in terms of, you know, having an actual card for the stadium. Donruss Triple Play, and I mentioned this in our podcast a few weeks back, Donruss Triple Play in 1992 had some stadiums featured, including Sky Dome. In fact, Sky Dome, now Rogers Center in Toronto, was card number one. And also Wrigley Field had a card, but not every team and their stadium was featured like it was on the back of these cards. So I actually like it. It was very unique. And like I said, pre-internet, this was bringing the game to the fans in a way that it hadn't really been done before in baseball card history. So 92 Tops, very sharp card. Like I said, the cardstock makes such a huge difference because the pictures are much cleaner. The text is easier to read. And of course, the condition of the cards, you didn't have to worry about as much of the layering and fraying as you had to with the gray cardstock from the previous 20 plus years that they had used it. Now, I mentioned that the value of the 92 Topps card is a little higher than some of the previous issues. The big card that everyone still chases is the Manny Ramirez high school card, actually, his rookie card from 92 Topps. And there are some other young players that had their rookie cards that you can still get for a decent price. But really, the biggest difference is in terms of wax boxes and complete sets, factory sets. A lot of sets from 1992, you see boxes for, you know, $10 to $15. You see complete sets, $15 to $20. Topps is, at least by my observation, a little bit higher. I've seen wax boxes going for $20 to $25. Now, there are some variations in the wax boxes, as the picture on the front of the box was alternated. You know, there's a, they would have this kind of a, you know, multi-card layered effect where the top card, one box would feature Kirby Puckett. Another box would feature Rob Dibble. Another box featured Bip Roberts, of all people. So there were several variations to the front of the box that stood out. So I think there may be some value. You know, maybe somebody's looking for that Kirby Puckett box over some of the others. But complete factory sets I've seen also in the neighborhood of $25 to $30, which again is a little bit higher than other sets. Now, one reason why the 92 factory set is a little higher too, as I mentioned in my own factory set story, is Topps included 8 gold cards. And that was the key chase element to the 92 Topps set, is having the gold card. And there were, of course, Topps brilliant in marketing, 2 different types of gold cards. You had the random gold card that was inserted every few packs. But then you had one that was earmarked winner. And it said winner right up above where the team name was. And you got the winner, basically, the scratch and win contest, which Topps would bring in and out every few years. In 1992, one of the prizes you could win was a pack of 10 winner cards. And I remember I won that, I think, twice. So I have a stack somewhere of probably about 25 cards, gold cards, and most of them are winner cards. I did occasionally get the random insert. Nothing big, nothing special. But the gold cards were certainly an added touch and one of the reasons why collectors still like 92 Topps, because while there's still a bunch of this product out there, if you get a gold Cal Ripken Jr., it's certainly far more valuable than just the standard Cal Ripken Jr., just for an example. Also, a unique thing that Topps did in 1992, they went back to the future in terms of some of their rookie cards, and in particular the late 1970s, where they would feature 4 rookies on one card, and they were from different teams. It's not like in the early 80s where you had, you know, Orioles future stars or Twins future stars, and you had pictures of 3 guys who were in the system. So you had 4 randomly selected players. And I always like that because it harkens back, like I said, to like 77, 78, where you had, you know, Dale Murphy and Paul Molitor, you know, Alan Trammell as well, guys who were featured on the rookie card of another player. And of course, that also goes back to especially the 1960s. And of course, the most famous one being 68 Topps with Nolan Ryan and Jerry Kuzman. So that was kind of a neat, in my opinion, part of the 92 Topps set. 92 Topps is a winner in my book, even though there are still a lot of this product out there. And even though it is slightly pricier to collect it, just because, again, there's still a chase for gold cards. But I think it's worth it. This is a fun set to put together. Like any other set, though, from 1992, do not expect it to rise in value. Do not expect to pay off any student loans with any cards that you find. But this is a fun set to put together and certainly look through once again. Front and back of cards, too. You've got something unique to have, even if that unique smell of cardboard wax and bubblegum is not there like it used to be in many, many, many boxes of Topps cards up until 1992. Now, speaking of unique, in 1991, Scott Erickson's 1991 season is one to remember not only for him, but for the Minnesota Twins, as Twins fans were not really picked to do anything in 1991. In fact, that World Series featured two teams that went from worst to first, the Twins and the Braves, and it's an epic World Series. In fact, this previous World Series, 2016, with the Cubs and Indians going to Game 7, a lot of people hearken back to Game 7 of the 91 series, and there were a lot of similarities in that. And one of the big reasons is Scott Erickson, who really just leapt off the page, and even though the Twins had a lot of players who contributed to that World Series, of course, Kirby Puckett being one, you had guys like Brian Harper, you had Ken Urbeck on that team. You had a lot of players who were a bigger part to that team, but Scott Erickson will always stand out from the Twins in 1991. And Erickson, a native of California from Long Beach, was drafted several times. Starting in 1986, he was a star at Homestead High School, drafted by the Mets, he doesn't sign, drafted by the Astros in 87, doesn't sign, drafted by the Blue Jays in 88, doesn't sign. In 1989, however, in the fourth round of the draft, coming out of the University of Arizona, he signs with the Minnesota Twins, and he makes a very fast rise up through their system, making his major league debut on June 25th, 1990, versus the Texas Rangers. Has a pretty decent rookie season. He goes 8-4 with a 2.87 earned run average, and also strikes out 53 batters to 51 walks. Now, the strikeout-to-walk ratio is almost always in favor of Erickson, but he would not be known as a strikeout pitcher. He was a predominant ground ball pitcher. This guy would get batters to ground into double plays numerous times. So I think that's part of his game that goes by the wayside, unfortunately, because he was an outstanding ground ball pitcher. And the fact that he did that often in the Metrodome, which had a field that had the consistency of a trampoline, says even more. If you can force ground balls that a decent infield can defend and get guys out, you're a pretty good pitcher if you were able to do that in the Metrodome, and he certainly did that in 1991. Now, that 91 season, like I said, was just miraculous. He started the season on a 12-2 run, 1.39 earned run average. He was the American League Pitcher of the Month in May and June. He was the first pitcher since 1954 to win 20 games in his first full year in the majors. And as I said earlier, he would finish up the season with a 20-8 record. And he also had an earned run average of 3.18. Amazingly, did not win the Cy Young Award that year. Roger Clemens did. And I think that goes to show a little bit of East Coast bias, but also how people still weren't taking the Twins seriously to where Roger Clemens wins. And of course, Clemens was deserving of it. But considering the type of season that he had, Scott Erickson really got left in the dust there in the Cy Young Award, finishing a close second place. Now, 1991 was also his only All-Star season, and he was in the MVP voting race, however, a very distant runner there, if you will, 17th overall in the MVP voting. Now, what's funny is, even though he is best remembered for the 91 season and for being a member of that World Series team in Minnesota, he was not that good in the playoffs in 1991. Made one start against Toronto in the ALCS, lasted only four innings, finished up that series with a 4.5 earned run average. And in the World Series against Atlanta, he started two games, but he only made it combined through 10 2/3 innings. He allowed 3 home runs, which was a little higher than his usual average, 10 hits, 7 runs, 6 of them earned, an earned run average of 5.06. So even though he was a part of that World Championship team, and even though he was a big reason why the Twins got there, of course, it turned out a collective effort for the Twins to win it. And of course, Jack Morris and his Game 7 heroics really carrying the mail in that series for Minnesota. So following the tremendous 1991 season, he has a subpar season in 92, finishes 13-12, a 3.4 earned run average. Now, the Twins were slipping tremendously then, too. In fact, as the Twins went, so did Scott Erickson. 1993, 8-19, a 5.19 earned run average. So you go from 20-game winner in 91 to a 19-game loser in 1993. Strike shortened 94 season, he goes 8-11 with a 5.44 earned run average. And then a full season in 1995 split between Minnesota and Baltimore. And that was a rather doozy of a trade, too, as Erickson went to Baltimore along with Scott Klingenbeck for Kamara Barte. So that kind of gives you an idea where the Twins were going in the mid-1990s and where they would stay for a very long time. So combined, he goes 13-10, a 4.81 earned run average. And he starts the 96 season off dealing with some injuries and a high earned run average. But then he has his one last decent season in 1997. Goes 16-7, 3.69 earned run average. And what I say about the postseason, you know, he wasn't that good with Minnesota in 1991. You look at his time in Baltimore in the 96 playoffs, he did okay, not so good in the ALDS, but in 2 games in the ALCS against the Yankees, which the Orioles would lose, he was actually the O's best pitcher. But in 97, he did not do very well against Seattle or Cleveland in the ALDS and ALCS, respectively speaking. So after that season, things start going downhill for him on and off the mound. 98 actually had a decent season, 16-13 with a 4.01 earned run average. But then after that, 15-12, 4.81. And then you look up the stats here. He missed the entire 2001 and 2003 season due to injuries. He would not have an earned run average under 5.55 throughout the remainder of his career. And his day of putting up double-digit wins, they were way over, as he never achieved more than 5 wins in a season. And he would bounce around through a series of free agent signings from Baltimore to the New York Mets, to the Texas Rangers, to the LA Dodgers, to the New York Yankees. So he really just bounced around here and there throughout the remainder of his season. The only deal that was not a free agent signing was the trade that he was involved with from the Mets to Texas at the 2004 deadline, where he went to the Rangers for Josh Hoffpower, who never made it out of the minor leagues. So even though Scott Erickson's career wound down rather sloppily in 2006, it was all done. He did finish just barely above 500 in the win-loss column, 142-136. Earned run average, not good, 4.59. And again, the strikeout-to-walk ratio in his career, 1252-865, so not spectacular, but again, an outstanding ground ball pitcher and a big reason why the Twins got to where they did in 1991. So given that the Twins have not won a World Series since 1991, in fact, they haven't been in one since 1991, Scott Erickson is still beloved to all the knowledge that I have about Twins fans, because he was a key reason why, mostly why they got there, not necessarily why they won it, because he was not very sharp in the playoffs that year, but certainly a big reason why there is a second World Series banner or pennant hanging up now in Target Field in downtown Minneapolis. And by the way, a belated happy birthday to Scott Erickson, who turned 49 yesterday. Groundhog Day 1968 was when he was born. Now, if you're wondering what happened to Scott Erickson afterwards, after all, it's been about 10 years since he's played. Well, he was involved in a lot of things. He was involved as a coach. He was a pitching coach for the Cleveland Indians minor league system for a couple years. He's also in the business side of things. He's a real estate developer in Mexico. He's the president of MLM, that's Major League Mechanics, which is a mechanics tutorial. And he's also done some broadcasting. He's done some color analysis on the college side, most recently with the Pac-12 Network. And he is also married to the lovely and talented Lisa Guerrero. So good for him, as he's also involved in the television and film production side with a company called Home Team Productions. So he's dabbled in a lot of things, but if there's one thing that Scott Erickson will always be remembered for, it's that magical 1991 season with the world champion Minnesota Twins. So there we go, a look at Scott Erickson's career, the 1992 top set, which is an absolute winner. Still one that's fun to collect if you get your hands on it, get a few extra bucks, and a few more than a lot of the other sets from 1992. And again, don't expect to make a windfall of cash off this set unless you happen to find a pack full of Manny Ramirez rookie cards in pristine mint condition, which probably won't happen. But what you can expect is a really sharp set, a beautiful set, some great photography, great star selection, quality cards, and also still that chance you may pull a valuable gold card 25 years later, which is kind of neat. So there you go, 1992 Tops. You could talk about that. You could talk about our random poll, number 605, Scott Erickson, or anything about the hobby on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And make sure you tune in Tuesday as we have another Wax Ecstatic coming your way as we finally flip the calendar to 1993. And we'll take a look at the Bowman set from that year, which took the groundbreaking 92 set to a completely different level. And once again, cemented Bowman in as the card for the prospect lover, for those who love rookie cards. Even if the guy doesn't see the major leagues for another 8 years, Bowman was your set now and certainly back in 1993. Again, that will come your way on Tuesday via Audio Boom and iTunes. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to another edition of Wax Ecstatic.